Even if you are not a fan or follower of baseball, you're probably aware of all the numbers used in baseball. And to be fair, there are lots of stats in lots of sports, but baseball seems to thrive on all kinds of measurements of hitters and pitchers and fielders and teams. And there are two distinct schools now, followers of the old traditional stats and adherents of newer stats that they find to be better measurements. Keith Law writes of the whole picture in Smart Baseball, the story behind the old stats that are ruining the game, the new ones that are running it, and the right way to think about baseball. Keith Law is steeped in baseball knowledge and numbers. He spent several years working as a special assistant to the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, in charge of all statistical analysis. He now applies his knowledge as the senior baseball writer for ESPN, which includes on-air stints on the network's Baseball Tonight. Keith Law, pleasure to have you on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So baseball can be resistant to change, to put it mildly. How long did it take for this sabermetrics to catch on?
So you started to see the first signs of it in the early 2000s, maybe very late 1990s, when the Oakland A's were using this, which was later chronicled in the book Moneyball. I think the publication of that book in 2003 certainly sparked a few other teams to investigate using statistical analysis. And then the bigger bump really came on the Red Sox, were taken over by Theo Epstein, who publicly embraced analytics, hired several high-profile analysts, including Bill James, to work for the organization, and they went on to win World Series in 2004 and 2007 under his stewardship, which I think was a real eye-opener for other clubs, even for ownership groups, who could then go to maybe their resistant general managers and say, hey, if the Red Sox are doing this and they're winning, why aren't we doing this if only for purposes of competitive intelligence? And that accelerated the adoption throughout the sport to the point where this year, for the first time, all 30 major league franchises have full-time analytics departments in baseball operations.
All right, so success really bred success. The success of the teams that were using it convinced the ones that weren't to go ahead and jump on the train.
Yes, exactly. I think that's, that's true in most businesses, but I think there may have been more of an uphill battle in baseball.
Keith, why is it called sabermetrics?
That name was coined, I believe, by Bill James himself because of the Society for American Baseball Research, SABR, and he coined the term, needing a word for the use of statistics specifically as applied to sports in general. It doesn't just have to apply to baseball, but it was first applied to baseball because, as you mentioned in the intro, baseball is just particularly prone to the compilation of statistics and thus just statistical analysis.
Yeah, it seems like lots of statistics get added all the time, and the old ones don't necessarily get taken away. In your opinion, what kinds of mistakes have been made relying on older statistics?
You can see it across the board. You've seen managers use players incorrectly because, for example, they were managing to the save stat, or because they would adhere to the old idea that you needed your number two hitter to be a guy who didn't strike out much and could run, as opposed to a guy who's just a good hitter who you want towards the top of the lineup. You've seen a lot of teams, general managers, make mistakes in signing players by relying on, say, win totals for acquiring a pitcher through trade or free agency and overpaying him based on the assumption that those win totals would carry forward to the new club, when in fact, whether a pitcher gets a win or not is not so much about how he pitched, but whether his team scored a lot of runs for him.
So in some cases, is the win statistic based on just the lucky day for the pitcher? I mean, he held the line enough and his hitters did better than the other team?
Exactly. It really, if you break down all of the variables that go into whether or not a starting pitcher got a win on a given day, you find the pitcher himself contributed less than half. It's a question of, did his offense score for him? And only while he was in the game, because once he's out of the game, it doesn't matter. Did his defense do a good or poor job behind him? What did the bullpen do after he left? What did the manager choose to do when he chose to pull the starter, or what moves he makes afterwards? That's, none of that is actually about how the pitcher pitched himself. A pitcher can pitch poorly and get a win. A pitcher can pitch extraordinarily well and not get a win, maybe even get a loss, depending on what other players do around him.
Are there places where, for example, the general manager has already adopted the use of the newer statistics in drafting and signing players, but the field manager is not necessarily embracing it?
Yeah, I think that's probably, you sort of nailed the most common conundrum now for major league organizations, where you see a club like the Mets, whose front office is extremely stat savvy.
I grew up a Mets fan, I just want to be clear.
Okay, my condolences.
Yeah, I know.
But Sandy Alderson is very stat savvy. He was with the A's in the late 90s and early 2000s when they were the earliest adopters. And the front office is extremely stat savvy. They've had some very bright people, including math PhDs, go through there. And Terry Collins is just impervious to logic. He had to be basically backed into playing Michael Conforto, now their best hitter, by injuries, despite the fact that even a cursory look at Conforto's entire track record in the majors, minors going back to college, said this guy needed to be playing every day and towards the top of the lineup.
And he's an Oregon State graduate, too. So that's
right. Oh, that's right.
That
I forgot that.
Yeah. So,
yes.
So, but Conforto's fielding is not a good reason to keep him out of the lineup. His bat is that good?
His bat is better. He was essentially the argument I've made is they have a team of corner outfielders, right? There's really no everyday center fielder on that roster. And that's a bigger part. You can't blame that on the manager. But if you rank all of the corner outfield candidates, he's one of their top two. He and Cespedes are the top two offensive corner outfield candidates on the roster. We have two corner outfield spots, so those two have to play. And then you have to fake center field somehow. But Collins seemed to go out of his way to not play Conforto, which I think is consistent of Collins' history of not trusting rookies, probably because he doesn't believe in the analysis we can do on minor league stats, and choosing to play veterans, even though those veterans may have less skills or worse track records.
So let's consider a broad view then right here up front. I mean, could or should baseball be run more or less by computer and taking the manager's gut completely out of it?
Well, the manager's gut is probably you don't want a manager making decisions by gut, just like you don't want people in any business making decisions by gut. But you need a manager to manage personalities, to handle the clubhouse, to talk to players who might have been starters their entire lives, get to the majors, and then suddenly they're asked to take on a reserve role. So there's personality management. But when you're talking about in-game management where we have data that can inform decisions, that should be present all the time. And I would have no problem with a manager who was essentially deciding off of information because we have so much historical data on the likelihood of a run scoring if we have a runner on second and one out. We have a pretty good idea of how likely it is he's going to get home. You don't want the manager throwing that out the window because his gut tells him that the guy at the plate is more likely to get a hit.
Well, a quick specific example, Joe Maddon and his use of Aroldis Chapman for the Cubs in Game 7 of last year's World Series. The world could see how tired he was, but was Maddon correct on the numbers?
I had a hard time with Maddon's managing in that last game, and I thought Maddon managed very well through the month of October. I thought Francona managed a little better. But I thought Chapman, one, looking tired, and two, coming into a situation with men on base, where Chapman goes almost exclusively fastball with men on base, which gives the hitter a pretty substantial advantage. That was where Maddon made a mistake. He should have brought Chapman into a clean inning.
All right, much more to talk about with Keith Law. His book is called Smart Baseball, and it's got a much longer subtitle. We're talking about stats, new and old and proper and not. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Keith Law and you in a minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. And it's a discussion about baseball today. We're going to get into some numbers here, but it's something that even non-baseball fans can appreciate because it's about how you measure a game, how you make decisions in it. And it's about new statistics and old statistics. Keith Law is the senior baseball writer for ESPN. His book is called Smart Baseball, the story behind the old stats that are ruining the game, the new ones that are running it, and the right way to think about baseball. Join the discussion on the Exchange. Your thoughts on baseball and all its measurings, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Is baseball a little more stat-saturated than any other sport, Keith?
I think it is. I think part of it is baseball's got the longer history, so we have over 100 years of not just of the data itself, but of looking at baseball through the lens of specific numbers. It is also a sport of highly discrete events that are very individual. You've got one pitcher and one batter, and you can break down every at-bat. Now we can break down every pitch to an individual line of data, whereas other sports, from what little I know about the analysis that goes on in them, sports like basketball and hockey in particular are more like flows rather than lines of very specific discrete data. It's a continuous stream, and the challenge that they've faced in other sports is that to evaluate any play or player, you have to keep constant track of where every player is on the court or on the ice. In baseball, that's much less of an issue, so it's been easier for people, even people without any kind of real background in data analysis or modeling, to get started.
So you do start with some of the old stats that you have issues with. You already talked about wins by pitcher, and we can get into that further later. But what batting average itself, you find, has some flaws.
It leaves too much out of the equation. And if you only look at a player's batting average, you're just getting a horribly incomplete picture of what he is as a player. Batting average ignores power entirely. It treats home runs and singles as if they're entirely equal events, which of course we know they're not. And it also ignores whether or not the player draws walks. And we know, and have, I think everyone's known for some time now, there's substantial value in that, because the most important job of a hitter is just to get on base, to not make an out at the plate. And batting average can leave quite a bit out, because the best players in baseball will draw, the most patient players in baseball will draw 100-plus walks a year. Batting average simply pretends that those don't exist. We have other similarly basic stats that do a much better job of addressing things that batting average just ignores.
Including the on-base percentage, is that the big one?
That's my favorite. Of all the old stats, all the ones that anybody could calculate at home, you might recognize from the back of a baseball card, that's the best. Because, again, I think the most fundamental job for a hitter is to get on base. The hardest thing for a hitter to do at the plate is to get to first base. It's much easier once you're on base to advance to further bases. And so on-base percentage expresses something extremely important in a very easy-to-understand way, and doesn't ignore the huge class of plate appearances that batting average does.
Now, I notice that there's the other statistic that gets put on the screen on a pretty regular basis now on TV telecasts, and that is the OPS figure, which is on-base percentage plus slugging percentage. And you call that a kludge stat, meaning what?
Meaning that it's essentially just people decided to jam two things together that didn't necessarily go together. You're adding on-base percentage, which is times on-base divided by plate appearances, and slugging percentage, which is a rough measure of power, that is total bases divided by at-bats. Well, if you've been through at least fourth grade math, you know you can't add two fractions with different denominators. But that's exactly what it does. It just smushes them together and produces a number that is not useless, because it tends to correlate, at least at a team level, very well with run scoring. But it can be very misleading. And I go through some examples in the book of how OPS really does a poor job with players who don't hit for a lot of power but get on base at extremely high clips. It tends to undervalue them and overvalue the Mark Trumbo, Evan Gattis type of player who both hit for a lot of power but are very poor at getting on base.
All right, so here's where we can bring in a stat that I had not seen before, the ABR, or adjusted batting runs. This is a replacement you're suggesting for some of this. And how is that one figured out?
So that is one of a class of statistics that are weighted averages of everything that the hitter does at the plate. Actually, batting runs is a cumulative stat. There are others that are averages. Everything that a hitter does at the plate, positive or negative, has some value to the team. It helps create runs, generate runs, or it destroys the possibility of scoring runs. And those values, individual values, might change year to year, but they're pretty roughly similar over the course of time, where a double is worth a bit more than a single, a home run is worth more than that, and an out, any out made at the plate, costs the team, is a negative value that's added in. And so for adjusted batting runs, you're simply adding up all of the values, every plate appearance that the hitter had, all the positives and all the negatives get added together into a single value that represents the cumulative total of how many runs he added, or I guess subtracted, from his team's potential to score runs as a whole.
So this brings up the issue of productive outs and whether there is such a thing, either in the realm of the people who do the measuring for the game, or your own personal feelings about it.
I think all outs are inherently unproductive. Some are less unproductive than others, but the idea that we should, say, applaud a player for making a productive out, as you see often in college and high school baseball, somebody makes an out, advances a runner, everybody's got to spill out of the dugout, slap hands, act like something good just happened. No, you're worse off. Every time there's an out made, you're never better off. You are probably worse off. You're always better off having a hit than having an out, with the one exception, which people always bring up as if it disproves the rule, of an out that ends the game by scoring a run. Okay, that's one where an out is as good as a hit, but you can never find a situation where an out is actually better than a hit, and that's why I say that no outs are actually productive.
Keith Law is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a senior baseball writer for ESPN and the author of the new book, Smart Baseball, the story behind the old stats that are ruining the game, the new ones that are running it, and the right way to think about baseball. So batting statistic that we haven't talked about yet, the older one, runs batted in, RBI, and you say this fails a simple logistical test of its merits.
Branch Rickey loved to say that RBIs weren't just misleading, they were dishonest. They are much more a measure of where a batter bats in the lineup and what the two players ahead of him do. If you put a mediocre hitter behind two guys who get on base at very high clips, Joe Carter for the Padres in 1990 behind Tony Gwynn and Roberto Alomar, who are on base all the time, well, guess what? Carter knocked in a ton of runs despite having kind of a lousy offensive season himself. He played a lot, which is important because it just lets you accumulate more opportunities. And then he had more RBI opportunities, I believe, than anyone else in the National League that year. And the old way of looking at a hitter just on his batting average, his home runs, and his RBIs, not only did it leave so much out of the equation like I described for average, but RBIs includes all kinds of irrelevant nonsense. You don't want to measure a hitter by how well the two hitters ahead of him in the lineup did. But that's essentially what that troika of stats had people doing in the media, fans, even front office people doing for close to 100 years.
So this is where you get a lot of quotes from the broadcasters as a guy comes up to play, well, here's the Mets' big RBI man.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it's just because somebody else gets on base ahead of them a lot.
That's why I say my favorite announcer sometimes is just the mute button. I'm fine hearing the sound of the crowd, but the platitudes we tend to hear. And they're the same ones that they've been saying for 30 or 40 years. The idea that someone is an RBI guy, that there's a special ability to get RBI. Look, if you can hit, you're going to knock in runs. I mean, that's it. The ability to hit is the one thing that is very individual and not context dependent, not dependent on what's around you in the lineup, who's ahead of you, whether people are on base. If you can hit, then you're going to knock in runs. If you can hit for power, you're going to knock in more runs. I'll even give you that corollary to it. But the idea that someone can be an RBI guy, that he really bears down when he can smell that RBI on second base, I mean, that is so much nonsense and is the kind of mythology that I was really trying to destroy in the first section of the book.
Well, and then let's get into another bit of that mythology, too, because you really go after the idea that people are clutch hitters. Is there such a thing as a clutch hitter once you pull apart all the stats?
There are clutch hits, but there are no clutch hitters. The idea of a hitter who can raise his game and somehow outperform in these so-called clutch situations, not only is it nonsense, but it's simply not borne out in the data. And if you look at all the players who are typically tagged as clutch, you find out that they were just great hitters all the time, regardless of the situation. And more thorough analyses, and I mention a couple in the book, looking at players over the course of long periods of history, have found the same, that there are no outliers. You would expect if clutch were a real skill that we would find a significant number of outliers, of players who outperformed in these clutch or close in late situations. And the reality is that they don't. It fits a normal distribution just like you'd expect from a distribution that was totally random.
So what about guys like Jim Leiritz, who seemed like he was, you know, at best marginal during the regular season and just could not stop hitting home runs in the postseason?
Typically, well, first of all, you'd expect to see, again, some of these kind of random outliers to begin with. But also what we run into with that is a bit of availability bias, too, which is that we remember a couple of big hits. Uh-huh. Luis Soho was another one with the Yankees, where during that run in the 90s, Luis Soho is always going to get the big hit. You just want him up in the RBI situation. He was a terrible hitter. He was not a very good baseball player to begin with. They loved him as a person, which is great, but it did not make him a better player. And I think people tried to attach this narrative to him as a better player to support the fact that they liked him as a person. But then you actually bore down, looked at the performance, you realized, no, it didn't bear out at all.
We actually get a chance to talk some inside baseball today here on the Jefferson Exchange with Keith Law, who is ESPN's senior baseball writer. He's written a book called Smart Baseball, the story behind the old stats that are ruining the game, the new ones that are running it, and the right way to think about baseball. And you can join this conversation on the Exchange, whether you're a deep-in-the-numbers baseball fan or somebody who's mildly interested in it. We'd like to hear what you're thinking about the ways of measuring the performance of athletes on the field of play. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Keith, for you, did some of the older stats fall out of favor with you gradually, or did you get out of bed one morning and go, wow, that one is just junk?
It was probably a pretty short transition for me. There was a period around the time I was getting out of college, in the early to mid-90s, where I realized that the old stats just weren't telling me any of what I thought they were. It was a very rapid disillusionment, because at the same time I was being introduced through the online sabermetrics community and through works by Bill James and some of his acolytes to better stats that did a much better job of stripping out context, focusing on individual performance independent of the performances of other players, and would help me just think better, project better on what players might be good going forward.
You know, it seems like you could really get yourself drowning in numbers. When I look at, you know, what I consider fairly productive at-bats, like a guy who can foul off 9 pitches and just wear the pitcher out might have some value in there, but I don't think there's any stat that measures that, is there?
You can look at pitches per plate appearance, and I often will, particularly if I scout a player myself and then think I'm seeing that ability. It's what I recognize, so this player's, he's had long at-bats, he's fouled off a bunch of tough pitches. Well, let's see if that's borne out over a larger sample, and that's, I guess, a very basic example of how you can integrate and how good teams will integrate scouting with analysis. Use the analysis, use the numbers to try to back up, verify, or disprove what the scouts say they're observing.
Oh, it's an interesting. So, yeah, so you might have an impression, but this way you get to look at the numbers inside and go, yep, that impression is not a fair one.
Yeah, exactly, because I go to games all the time, but I'm often just jumping in for one or two games here and there. I go see amateur players, minor league players, and you get an impression. And some of it is, some of scouting is just observing and saying, I like this guy's swing, I like this about his mechanics, you know, it's a below-average changeup, he's going to need to switch from a curveball to a slider. But then you're also making observations that, to me, are essentially asking to be verified going forward, like what you said. Oh, I think this guy takes good at-bats. I think this guy's a pretty rangy shortstop. Well, what do the defensive metrics say about his ability to get to more balls?
Okay, I pretty much just talked about people holding bats at the plate. Let's move on to the base paths and talk about stolen bases. Now, Ricky Henderson ruled here, but then what happens when you add up the caught stealing figure for some of these Giants?
Well, that's the problem I have with stolen bases. It's not that the stolen base itself is a bad thing, but that it has a cost or a risk. And I think the point, if you look at stolen bases, if you're looking at the stolen bases as a strategy, you need to consider that it is a strategy that comes with a potential cost. And the truth is, it's not even a one-to-one relationship. If you get caught stealing, that erases the gain from about three successful times stealing. It's a little more precise than that. I go into some of the math in the book. But the point is, you should not be running simply without consideration for what happens if it goes wrong. If you are successful less than 70% of the time that you try to steal, you are actually hurting your team's chances to score more runs.
All right, so let's move into pitching now, because we had talked about signing wins to a pitcher and all the problems you see there. But, I mean, for example, a guy like Greg Maddux, how would you have measured his effectiveness outside of the massive number of wins he accrued over all those seasons?
Well, he was extremely good at keeping guys off base. The three most fundamental things that a pitcher can do, and I'm not even talking about advanced stats, but if you're just trying to figure out whether a pitcher you think is going to be good at his job, does he miss bats, get a lot of strikeouts, does he avoid issuing walks, and does he keep the ball in the park? Well, Maddux was very good at all three. He never walked anybody. He missed a lot of bats. He despite the fact that he never threw harder than about 94 even at his peak, he could certainly miss bats through location and through changing speeds, and he could always sink his fastball. So he was a good ground ball guy, and he never gave up a lot of home runs. And so that made him extremely effective in a way that you might have associated with guys who threw harder or bigger or seemed to have more effort in their deliveries.
So what is the measurement that would have told you the most about Greg Maddux? Would it have been whip?
No, I would probably have looked at, well, first of all, his ERAs were actually pretty good indications of how he performed, because even some advanced stats might actually take away what we know of his ability to limit some hits on balls in play. And I talk a little bit, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I talk towards the end of Section 2 of Smart Baseball about wins above replacement, the idea of giving a player a total value, trying to estimate how much he was worth as a whole to the team. And Maddux ends up among the best of all time at that because he was very effective. He was he had a very long peak to his career and also pitched really well for an extremely long time.
All right, I'll come back to WAR later on, wins above replacement. I want to give some guides to the non-baseball folks here. When I mentioned whip, that's walks and hits per innings pitched, and ERA, of course, earned run average, which is the average of runs you'll give up over the course of nine innings. I'm really glad you brought up Harvey Haddix, because I think this is one of the saddest outcomes in baseball history, and he got ripped off when they changed his perfect game into a not-perfect game.
Yes, it's funny because I obviously I'm 43, so it's before my time, but I'm very familiar with the story. My parents remembered it well. They're in their early 70s now, and so they had, you know, when I read about it too, they remembered it happening and could tell me the story of it. And you know, I understand why they did the rule change, but I hated seeing Haddix taken out of the history books after throwing, I think it was 12 perfect innings. And his team couldn't score. Going back to what you were asking about pitcher wins, did he pitch well enough for a win? Of course he did. He didn't allow a base runner. You can't do any better than that. And yet, because his team didn't score, he was credited with, I think he ended up with the loss, actually, but he did not get the win, despite the fact that he could not have done anything more for those 12 innings.
Yeah, a perfect game is 9 perfect innings, and he pitched 12 perfect innings, and his team ended up losing in the 13th inning. So now, you mentioned briefly earlier the save by the guy who pitches last. Why do you think that's junk?
That might be the worst of the worst in terms of the damage it's done to the game. The save was invented by a sports writer in the late 1960s with some very arbitrary criteria that ended up changing a few times into the early 70s for what qualified a pitcher for a save. And what we have seen over the four decades plus since then is that teams have built their bullpens around the save. They have managers have chosen when to use guys specifically because of the save statistic, and we even compensate players differently as an industry because of that. And the end result is that typically your best reliever pitches less, and I can never see how that would be a good outcome. But managers will use inferior relievers earlier in the game because they are saving their best guy, their closer, for a save situation that might actually never arrive, a situation we all saw in the AL wildcard game last year where the Orioles lost in extra innings using two markedly inferior relievers while Zach Britton, their best reliever and maybe the best reliever in the American League last year, never got into the game.
He was just sitting there waiting for the save situation?
Exactly. And Showalter admitted the mistake. He never quite spelled it out that way. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a pretty broad consensus within baseball, and I asked a lot of people what they thought about that, that he was managing to the save or perhaps managing in fear of the save. If you use Britton, even for two innings, which he certainly could have done, then you take the lead some point after he's finished for the day. You have to use someone else, someone inferior, to come in and close the game out, to get the last three outs and then get a save in that situation. So, but my point was, you've got to get to that point first. You have to give your offense more chances to score. And by not using Britton, he didn't do that.
Yeah, a lot more that we can talk about with Keith Law about managing baseball games and deciding which players are going to be in the game in the first place based on their performance on stats other than the ones we used to use, average and home runs and RBIs, and certainly wins for pitcher and saves for relief pitchers. Smart Baseball is the book. Keith Law is the author and our guest. We'll come back and talk more with Keith and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we return to The Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a rare discussion about sports here on the program with senior baseball writer at ESPN, Keith Law, who has written a book about all the mountains of statistics that come out of baseball, but how they have indeed changed the game over time. His book is called Smart Baseball, the story behind the old stats that are ruining the game, the new ones that are running it, and the right way to think about baseball. It's about drafting players and scouting players and judging players once they're in the game by different sets of numbers than the ones that still show up in the newspaper box scores. Join us on The Exchange with your thoughts on the trends at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the save stat and how you really think that that's not a great thing. I love the use of the term proven closer trademark in the book because people do get hired as proven closers and they suddenly... Is it that they fall apart or is it just that they're sort of reverting to an average of their performance anyway?
Yeah, that's what I think it is that often these pitchers were not actually that good to begin with. But the save statistic, if you looked strictly at the saves, you would think they were better or think... I believe this mentality is finally starting to erode a bit in baseball, but there was often the feeling that only certain guys could pitch the ninth inning. You had to have that special something, that heart or that something else that would allow you to succeed in the ninth inning. And so teams would often ignore the fact that the underlying stats, what we would call the peripherals, things like strikeout rate, home run rate, walk rate, etc., were not very favorable. But the guy had a lot of saves, therefore he was a closer, and therefore he was qualified to continue being a closer. And you'd often see teams sort of caught off guard when a closer who I think everyone in the analytical world said that, well, that guy's going to regress at some point, the teams would be surprised and had invested a lot of money in those guys and often failed to have adequate replacements on hand.
It seems like when somebody is very successful, though, in that category, like Mariano Rivera was for the Yankees for so many years, that people think, well, I want a guy like that. And so, they end up hiring somebody for that sort of position, but not necessarily getting, by any means, the same kind of performance.
Yeah, I think that's true. People would try to model after what teams in baseball are certainly imitated. One team has success at something, and other teams try to copy it. The Royals in 2014 and 15 had two straight World Series appearances. They won one of them, and their approach was their hitters put the ball in play a lot without a lot of power. They had a very good defensive club. That's not that novel. And they had essentially three closer-type pitchers. One pitched the seventh, one pitched the eighth, and one pitched the ninth. And so you saw, and they were all power arms, too, very hard throwers. And so you saw a quick run in baseball where everyone was trying to mimic that model across the board. Let's get hitters who don't strike out so much. They're not that easy to find. Let's get three guys for the late innings who all throw hard. Well, they're also not that easy to find, and it turns out two of the three guys the Royals had ended up with serious arm injuries. So it's not a very sustainable model. And I think you saw that with Rivera, with Trevor Hoffman, where teams saw those clubs that had ace closers, so to speak, and said, well, let's create our own. And again, it's not that easy. Rivera's a Hall of Famer, and Hoffman's probably going to be one too.
You know, I went back and checked, because one of my complaints about the save statistic is some of the ways in which it's applied, and I did go back and check, and Wes Littleton got a save for the Rangers when they beat the Orioles 30-3 in 2007.
That might be the worst one ever, although there are a lot of contenders for that. There was one the other day where it was something like 13-3 and someone got a save for it, because tacked on to the end of the save rule, all these complicated rules about the lead, you have to finish the game and the lead can only be this much, or there have to be certain guys on base, or... throw all that out. If the reliever threw three innings effectively, the team won, and he finished the game, he can still get a save.
Wow. And that was how Wes Littleton got in. So let's turn to fielding. We haven't talked about that at all yet. I mean, the effectiveness with the glove, as you point out, is based on errors, and you find that itself in error.
It kills me that people still use it. Now, that's more fans and occasionally media, never front offices anymore. But the idea of citing an error total or a fielding percentage, which is just essentially another derivation from the error total, as a measure of a fielder's prowess, not only is it out of date, but I think I can destroy it in about a sentence or so. Just think of the plays not made. If a ball is hit that any shortstop would convert into an out, but for whatever reason, he doesn't get to it. It goes through his legs, it goes to his left. He never gets a glove on it. It's not an error. If a fielder doesn't touch a ball, it's not an error. That's not quite in the statute, so to speak, but it is in practical terms. That's how the error is applied. Those balls put into play count, and if your fielder is more effective at converting balls hit in his direction to outs than someone else, then he's a better fielder, even if the first guy ends up making a few more errors, because of course he does. He's getting to more difficult plays. He's touching balls in play that never actually that most fielders would never actually get to in the first place. I think that's fairly obvious, and yet people still cling to fielding percentage because it's what we always used.
So in fairly simple terms, if a guy says, I'm not going after that ball, he ends up with no error and therefore looks like a better fielder with his percentage.
Exactly. And I mentioned Brian Downing, who was a converted catcher at a couple seasons in left field where he had a 1,000 fielding percentage because he never made an error. Well, of course he didn't. He was a statue out there, and so he had no range. That's a lot of doubles and triples that fall in. I'm sure his pitchers didn't appreciate it, but his numbers were pristine.
So, and you get into how obviously we did, you know, decide the winner of the batting title by the old-fashioned percentage. You know, you get awards for doing things right. And I wonder, particularly in this category, in fielding, though, I mean, gold gloves getting awarded, those are still pretty heavily based on fielding percentage, aren't they?
They have modified the formula just within the last maybe 3 years to incorporate advanced statistics like defensive runs saved, which is from the company Baseball Information Solutions. You can find that number on Baseball Reference and on Fangraphs. That's an advanced metric that does a much better job. Before then, Gold Gloves were just coaches' votes, which was awful because not only are they not even looking at stats at all, but, hey, this guy made a couple great plays against us in that series in July. I'll vote for him. That's not how you give out awards.
Is that how David Wright won the Golden Glove over Chipper Jones in one of his final seasons?
Oh, I don't know specifically, but that wouldn't surprise me, certainly. And, you know, there's also a lot of legacy, where Derek Jeter won a bunch of Gold Gloves because he was super popular and he could really hit. And Omar Vizquel was winning Gold Gloves past the point where he was actually one of the better shortstops defensively in baseball. So it was a bad process that's only gotten marginally better.
Oh, okay, so they won on reputation rather than what they've done recently.
Exactly. And, you know, the worst example of all, I think, is Rafael Palmeiro winning on reputation in a year where he only played 28 games at first base. He was largely a DH that year, and yet people were so used to writing his name in, they just wrote him in without actually looking. What did he play the position at all? And of course, Rawlings should have just invalidated the vote, but they let it go through, which is useful for me because I get to make fun of it.
Thank you so much, Rawlings. To the very construction of the lineup, we hinted at this a little bit before. I mean, you want the guys who get on base ahead of the guys who can knock them in, although you have some doubts about RBIs. So are lineups being constructed differently? I've noticed that even with the Mets, Terry Collins, as hidebound as he can be, is occasionally letting the pitcher bat eighth, for example.
And it seems like there's a little benefit to that. All the potential lineup changes or improvements, I'm talking about the batting order specifically, where you put hitters in the lineup, these are all small gains. I have simply argued they're there for the taking. You might as well use them. And teams can run extensive simulations to to try to figure out what the best place is for each of your hitters. And you'd probably have two lineups, one against right-handed starters, one against left-handed starters. The most important lesson of all, than the one I spend time on in the book, is that you want your best hitter to bat second. That is the ideal combination of maximizing his plate appearances over the course of a full season and still giving him plenty of RBI opportunities, because obviously if you put him first, he's going to get the most plate appearances, but he's often going to come up with nobody on base. If you put him lower in the lineup, he'll come up with more guys on base potentially, but he'll have fewer plate appearances over the course of the season.
Ah, so certainly in the top three, and this is why I'm guessing you're not much on the concept of a cleanup hitter, number four.
I'm a bit standing on the shoulders of others when it comes to this research, but what those who've run these simulations have found is that you put your best hitter second. You actually should put your second best hitter, I'm talking about overall production, getting on base and power together, fourth, because the third spot comes up too often with nobody on base because of the way lineups turn over and because you're often coming up with two outs and nobody on in the first. It's actually not a good spot to put your best or even your second best hitter. Again, the differences over the course of a season are marginal. It's a couple of runs here or there. But like I said before, why not just take it? This is the easy stuff. And if you can gain a few runs over the course of a season by optimizing your lineup, just do it.
Let's come back to the on-base percentage, because this is a big one of the old stats that you favor here, and it does get a whole chapter here. And you look at Andre Dawson versus Tony Gwynn for the most valuable player in the National League in 1987. What were the circumstances there?
So Dawson led the National League in home runs and RBIs, playing for a last-place team, which at the time nearly disqualified you from winning the MVP award. He had also signed a one-year contract well below his actual value with the Cubs because of collusion. That was the year, for folks who don't remember, where the owners colluded to not sign free agents, and Dawson and his agent gave a blank contract to the Cubs and said, just put in whatever dollar amount you want and I'll sign. And they paid him, well, far less than he was worth, which I think engendered some sympathy among the voters. But the reality is, he wasn't close to the most valuable player in the National League that year. He just had the most home runs and the most RBIs, a nice little narrative. Tony Gwynn, who I'm sure listeners are familiar with, had a much better season. He got on base at a much higher clip. He added a ton of value on the bases. He was a good defensive outfielder. He didn't even get close to the top in the balloting because Dawson won on traditional stats that at the time, that was all anybody looked at. And despite the fact he posted, I think, a 328 on base percentage that year, nobody looked at that stat back then. Nobody recognized that that was far more important than some of the other statistics that were valued more highly.
So something glittery that happens in a season certainly can do a lot to improve a player's chances of winning a major award like a most valuable player. And the other classic example you give is Ted Williams losing to Joe DiMaggio in 1941.
Yes, DiMaggio had the 56-game hitting streak, which is legendary, but is not in and of itself valuable. A player having a long hitting streak is interesting, to a fan, certainly, but it does not demonstrate anything about value, and plenty of mediocre hitters have had 30-game hitting streaks in baseball history. Williams was also apparently not very popular with the media at the time, and unfortunately that has very frequently come up in voting, where players are penalized for not being so media-friendly. Barry Bonds was penalized a couple times in his career for the same thing.
Steve Carlton was legendarily nasty to
surly, very surly with the media, which also probably hurt him, and no, I think it's still hurting Bonds. Obviously, Bonds has other things working against him in the Hall of Fame voting, but he might have gotten a little more benefit of the doubt if the media had loved him. Personally, as someone I've voted for postseason awards, I'll get a Hall of Fame vote in about 18 months. I think that's stupid. I think it's a little irresponsible. We are professionals. We should be able to rise above that and just evaluate players on the merits of their performance.
So you would vote for Barry Bonds for the Hall of Fame?
Oh, no question. And I would vote for Roger Clemens, too, who was apparently also kind of an unpleasant guy and has the same kind of accusations hanging over his head. But these were also two, you know, arguably, the best position player and the best starting pitcher in the last 50 years. The Hall of Fame is highly incomplete without them.
All right, so let's. I wanted to ask this anyway, just based on the overall weight of the book. I mean, are there guys that you would toss from the Hall of Fame if you got to be the king of the Hall of Fame by today's stats?
Yeah, it's a dangerous precedent. So I'm speaking very hypothetically here, but yes, there are a number of players in who don't belong in. Among recent inductees, Jim Rice was an awful selection. He was a poor on-base guy or mediocre on-base guy, an awful defender, a terrible base runner, and was basically done as a regular by age 32. Tony Perez got in because of an RBI total and because he played a long time. He was certainly never among the best players in his league. And I spend more time on Bruce Sutter because he was elected because of his role rather than his performance. He was the first modern one-inning closer. that's largely because he couldn't stay healthy in any other role and because his manager chose to use him in that way. And even with that, his career was short, his peak was short, he has the lowest innings pitch total of anyone in the Hall of Fame. He might be the first one to throw out the door because, unfortunately, he's made it possible for other closers like Trevor Hoffman to get consideration.
All right, so let me make sure we get into wins above replacement because that is a huge one now in today's baseball world and one I still don't quite understand myself.
And there's multiple ways to calculate it, which I think adds to the confusion. I describe it right at the start of the chapter. I say this is a construct rather than a specific stat. It is the idea that you want to value everything a player does and be able to add them together into one number compared against a common baseline. Because if you're a general manager and you're looking at a player in free agency, you need to know how much he's worth. How much do I offer to pay this guy? You don't simply say, well, I want to offer more than anybody else. There has to be some dollar amount where you say, I'm going to stop here because the player is not worth that much. And so there are multiple ways to get at this, and each team, I think, has its own proprietary formula. But for just to give an example for a hitter, you're adding up, you mentioned his batting runs. How much is all of his offense worth, positive or negative? How much was he worth on the bases? Not just what he stole, but is he going from first to third or second to home more often than the average runner? How much is his fielding worth, which is a very complex problem, and every team has its own proprietary defensive metrics. You're adding all of those up and then comparing them to a common baseline. You could use average, but when I asked team analysts and front office executives, they all said they use replacement level, which is this constant percentage of average that represents what you could get if you could just go to AAA and grab a fill-in player who's not really worth anything, but he's essentially there for free. That's your common baseline. That's what you're comparing everyone to at his position. So shortstops to shortstop, center field to center field. You just need that one baseline so that you can convert that into a dollar figure and make rational decisions.
Wow, which is what it gets down to for the general managers, certainly, but for the fans, it's a whole bunch of different stuff, which is why I guess we're still arguing over all the different stats out there. Smart Baseball is the name of the book. Keith Law, ESPN senior baseball writer, is the author. It's been a pleasure, Keith. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.